We're doing Parshat Mishpatim. We'll dedicate our learning tonight to Hena Bat Bela Rachel. Parshat Mishpatim takes us through just that, the laws, bottom line laws, the whole legal system that we have. And ordinarily we run through the parsha, we do an overview and then we do more depth. Tonight I think that maybe our overview should just be a glance at the mitzvot in the parasha, to quickly run through the mitzvot in the parasha, and then we'll start going through it with more depth. So we have the mitzvah of a Hebrew slave going out after on the seventh year. We have a mitzvah when we take a young Jewish girl as a servant to marry her, either the master or his son. We have a mitzvah to redeem the young Jewish servant, meaning there's actually a mitzvah to try and help her buy her way out. There's a mitzvah that Beis Din should execute when necessary. There's a mitzvah that Beis Din should tax when necessary. The Torah gives us different taxes for different offenses. There's a mitzvah that the courts should judge when an animal harms, either by goring or by eating or by trampling. So each time there are different laws how much is paid. There's a mitzvah that Beis Din should judge when a person uncovers something damaging in public domain, what's called a bar, a pit. There's a mitzvah that the courts should force a thief to pay double. Or if a person stole a human being, he kidnapped and made him work, so then he gets a death penalty. There's a mitzvah that Beis Din should deal with damages of a fire. If someone lit a fire and it damaged, Beis Din have to deal with it. Beis Din have to deal with a person who took responsibility to watch someone else's item, either for free or for pay, or he rented it, or borrowed it, and then there are different cases that Beis Din has to judge. There is a mitzvah for Beis Din to judge a situation where a man seduces a young girl. There's a mitzvah that a person who purchases a girl as a servant shouldn't sell her. There's a mitzvah that when a person purchases a young girl, so then if he marries her, he shouldn't treat her less than any other wife. He has to give her as much as he gives any other wife. And from here we actually learn the halachos of what a husband owes his wife. She'er k'sus and ona. There's a mitzvah not to hit one's parents. There's a mitzvah that if an ox murders, an ox gores and kills, then it gets executed. And there's a mitzvah not to eat the flesh of that ox. There's a mitzvah not to let a witch remain, or there's a mitzvah not to afflict a convert, not to afflict him monetarily, and not to afflict him verbally. There's a mitzvah not to afflict a widow or an orphan. We have a mitzvah to give poor people loans. We have a mitzvah that when the court judges, they should go after the majority opinion. We have a mitzvah to help someone load and unload an animal. We have a mitzvah of Shemitah, letting the land go fallow and rest. We have a mitzvah of resting on Shabbos, and the mitzvah to rejoice, to bring a Korban Chagiga on the Regalim, on the holidays. We have the mitzvah of bringing the Bikurim, the first fruits, and the mitzvah not to demand of a poor person to pay when we know he can't afford it. You know he can't pay, so don't just come and bug him. We have a mitzvah not to assist a person who's giving a loan with interest, not to assist in the one who gives the loan or takes the loan. A mitzvah not to curse a judge, and a mitzvah not to blaspheme. A mitzvah not to curse the nasi, and a mitzvah not to change the order of the gifts of the crops. A mitzvah not to eat an animal that's a treifa, and a mitzvah not to listen to one person's claim before the defendant is standing there opposite him. If two people have an argument, the Torah says you have to hear them both out at the same time. We have a mitzvah not to go after the majority opinion. Not to go after the majority opinion in a case that involves the death penalty. If the majority opinion says to execute, you do not go after that opinion if it's a majority of one. Special mitzvah in the Torah. Don't go by a majority of one in such a case. There's a mitzvah that if a person was in court and he had a vote to vindicate the person, he shouldn't turn back on that and start saying, oh, you gotta give him the death penalty. There's a mitzvah not to have mercy on a poor person when you're judging the case. The justice has to be justice, and you can't have mercy on the poor. What's fair is fair. We have a mitzvah not to treat a sinner badly in justice. Just because he's a sinner doesn't mean the justice system should work against him. We have a mitzvah that the courts shouldn't judge just because they think so. They have to have clear-cut proofs. A mitzvah not to take a bribe. A mitzvah not to take a vow in the name of an idol. A mitzvah not to try and lead a fellow Jew astray after idol worship. A mitzvah to not to slaughter the paschal offering while we still have chametz in our possession. Not to leave over any of the paschal offering for the next day. Not to cook meat with milk. Not to make a peace treaty with one of the seven nations or any other pagan, and not to leave idol worship in our land. So that's many mitzvahs we just went through, about 52 mitzvahs in our parsha. So 52 mitzvahs out of 613, that's almost 10% of the Torah is in our parsha. And we mentioned earlier that you have about a quarter of the Shas is based in our parsha. So there's a lot to go through. Okay, before we begin, there are many points we could focus on in our parsha. Is there anything in particular that bothers you that you would want us to discuss?
The slave children.
That's what I thought you'd talk about, slavery. But that's what I did previous years. The whole idea of slavery. Okay, so
specifically the children, how if they give birth when they're in slavery, the kids are slaves.
So I think we have to work on the whole picture. And then maybe we'll also get to deal with that detail as well. But because this involves an element of hashkafa, of how we view certain things in Torah, so there are many different approaches to the mitzvos of the Torah. I can share some that I know, but I always say when we begin discussions of faith and hashkafa, that because there are different approaches, be open-minded. If you don't like what I have to say, so keep shopping. Go to someone else's share, ask another Rebbe, and see if you get a better answer there. Yeah?
I'd be interested to hear about the laws relating to Congress also.
Okay, we'll try to get to that too. Okay. Let's begin. So, on the surface, we hear about one Jew buying another Jew as a slave. It seems pretty harsh. We have to understand where the idea comes from. And then we'll move on to children and we'll try to develop it. A person is having trouble financially. He reaches a point where he can't make ends meet, can't find a job. So he has the option to sell himself as a servant. And it's a pretty good option. Because let's say the master is having steak for dinner. He gets it too. And if there isn't enough for both of them, the servant gets it. Let's say he's drinking good wine. Servant gets some too. And if there isn't enough for both of them, the servant gets it. The Rambam writes, the master treats the servant like his own brother. When the master buys the servant, so then he takes the responsibility to deal with the welfare of his whole family. He's going to cover rent, he's going to cover heat, he's going to take care of what they need. So it's a beautiful welfare system. It's a welfare system where on the one hand, a person can say, I can't deal anymore. Someone else has to take control of my life. But when he does that, he doesn't get a handout. He's not getting a freebie. We say, okay, if you can't deal with life, so you can sell yourself as a servant. And then it's true, you're taken care of, but you're also going to be told what to do. Meaning your master's going to tell you what time you wake up. Your master's going to tell you when you go to sleep. He's going to tell you no TV tonight, yes TV tonight, no internet. Go out there and sew some clothing for me. You can't deal with life. You want to give up your life to someone else. You're saying, I need help, I need welfare. Someone else has to feed my wife and kids. Fine. The Torah says, I'll take care of you. I don't like it. Hashem says, you're supposed to be free men, but okay, you can sell yourself, and you'll be taken care of, but there's a price. You lose your freedom. Yeah. I'm with you, Yoni.
A little bit similar to the army, here that they cover all your medical expenses. You get three meals a day. You get everything you want, but in order to take a vacation, very difficult process, and you don't get to pick when you want to wake up, and it is difficult work. But essentially, you're busy, and you get all your needs taken care of.
Yeah.
Even better than if you had all the means in the civil life, and you took care of them however you want.
If it's a nice analogy. And the same thing happens if a person stole, and then he suddenly can't pay. So the courts say, okay, you chose to steal, and now you can't pay. And if you can't get the money together, then there will be circumstances where the courts will sell the person as a servant. But again, you see the beautiful responsibility that the Torah gives a person, that a person has the capacity, he's allowed to opt out. He's allowed to say, I'm stuck, I can't make it work. And the Torah says, fine, then I have a plan for you. You're going to end up your service, your wife will have been fed, your children will have been taken care of, and you're going to have money in your pocket, because at the end of the day, you get paid for those years of work. But it's not what I want. It's a cop-out of life. But sometimes people need a cop-out of life. So it's not, let's have a welfare system, we'll all fund it, we'll all pay for people, and then, well, how do you figure out if they're really looking for jobs? It's an approach that says it's not going to be too comfortable for you. It's true, if there's only one pillow, the servant gets it, not the master. But at the end of the day, he is a servant. So that's the system the Torah set up. Let's move on. Part of the punishment that the Torah gave a person if he takes this option is that the Torah says the master can tell him, you owe me at night as well. Meaning, even though ordinarily he might say, I want to go home and sleep with my wife, the master can say, no, I want you to bring me children. I have servants, I have female servants who are shifchos knanios, and you're going to spend two nights a week with this shifcha, another night a week with that shifcha. I want you to bring me children. And it's a very interesting situation, because if a regular Jew would live with her, that would be prohibited. But he, we're not going into all the details of when, but under certain circumstances, he has given over that aspect of his life to the master as well. And that's not something, we don't view it as he's married to her, because, for example, the Torah will not let him marry that non-Jewish servant unless he already has a wife of his own. Because the Torah didn't want him to form a bond with her. The Torah didn't want him to end up saying, I want to stay with her. The Torah wanted him to know, I have a family out there and I'm going back to my family. And no, the Torah permitted it. It's not correct. Now, we also have to understand what it means to have a non-Jewish servant. When a Jew purchases a non-Jewish servant, he notifies him, you have 1 year to decide. Within a year, you have to decide, do you want to accept Torah and mitzvot, to be observant of the Torah and mitzvot as a woman would, both male and female, non-Jewish servants, undergo a gear process. They're given a choice. If within the year you want to continue, within that year, you will be circumcised if you're a man, you will go to mikveh, and it will all be for the sake of avdut, of being an Eved Kenani, and then you'll be obligated in mitzvot like a woman. So it's not that he's really marrying a non-Jewish woman. He's marrying a shifcha Kenanit, which is somewhere in between being not Jewish and Jewish. It's a type of gear that's half a gear. It's not a complete gear. You guys with me? The Torah gave us this middle status. You have Jew and non-Jew and in between. The in-between is an Eved Kenani. You guys with me so far?
Yes, but agree to this in-between stage?
Correct. A man and a woman are both given a choice. You have 1 year to decide. Do you want to become obligated in mitzvot? And if not, we'll sell you onward to the non-Jewish nations. Now, if they're intelligent, they will accept it, because not only because it's the truth, but also because it's a better life. Meaning, we have limitations. If a Jewish owner kills his non-Jewish slave, he gets a death penalty. Meaning, the Torah has certain laws protecting the slave. So, it's in his interest.
Is that a purpose? Is that a purpose, being slave, being made to be slave and Jewish in the Shkalani?
I'm not understanding. I'm sorry.
What's the purpose, being middle, you know, like not being non-Jew, being non-Jewish and Jewish? What's the purpose of being middle?
What's the
option?
So I
think that in order to understand that, we have to understand other aspects of a non-Jewish slave. In general, the Torah teaches us that we have extensions of ourselves. Meaning, there's you, and then there's your name. There's you and the clothing you wear. There's you and your house. There's you and your wife. There's you and your kids. Different things have different levels of connections to us. And this has halachic relevance. Let's take a simple example. Your animal may not work on Shabbos. If your non-Jewish neighbor wants to borrow your animal, he may not make it work on Shabbos. It's your animal. He's allowed to work on Shabbos, but not with your animal. So you see, even though it's an animal, the Torah says your animal has to rest on Shabbos. Your non-Jewish servant also has to rest on Shabbos. Your animal may not eat certain truma food and other things, right? Holy foods your animal may not eat, right? So that means the halacha views certain things that you own as an extension of yourself. If your animal does damage, you're responsible. So both on a holiness level and on a responsibilities level, your animals and your assets are an extension of yourself. Now a servant is more of an extension of yourself. We have halachot that a servant can eat certain holy foods, the servant of a kohen, right? We have certain halachot that a servant is an extension of the kohen or of the Israelite. So the Torah says, okay, you're going to take the servant, then he has to become one with you on a certain level. On the other hand, he's not going to become a full-fledged Jew. So the Torah gave him a middle status. He's responsible for mitzvot like a woman. If he would remain where he was, so then it wouldn't really work. That's not what the Torah wanted.
When he's free, is he still in that middle state?
No. When an Eved Kanani goes free, then he becomes Jewish.
Oh.
He's a full-fledged Jew. Right. Correct.
Oh.
If he'll ever get free, yeah.
Does he get free after the seventh year?
No. An Eved Kanani is there for life. Now, by the same token, when the Torah punished the Jewish servant and said, your nights are not yours. Your master is going to tell you what you do with your nights. This isn't where the Torah wanted him. And so the children that woman has are not his children. He might say, I love him, I want to stay with them, and then the Torah allows him to extend his stay, but that's not what the Torah wanted. The Torah wanted him to go back to his family outside. The Torah didn't want him to remain as a servant. And that's why if he's going to go and say, I want to extend my service, the Torah limits it. And the Torah also says he gets his ear pierced. The Torah saying you're taking a step in the wrong direction.
You mentioned the Eved Kanani and Eved and this in-between conversion option. So when does
the Eved Kanani undergoes the in-between conversion option?
Correct.
Every Eved Kanani must undergo that.
And if they refuse, that means that they're sold out.
Well, sold out, yeah.
Is there really an Eved Kanani?
That is an Eved Kanani. That is. Every time you read about an Eved Kanani, that's what it is. That in-between stage, yes. Now,
Eved
Ivri is a regular Jew. Yeah, a Jew that sold himself. Now, the Torah allows us to marry off our daughters from the day that they're born. The Torah says, the halacha says, if a person marries off his daughter before she knows who she wants to marry, that's an improper thing. That's really wrong. A person has to wait till his daughter is old enough and intelligent enough to say, I want him. Don't marry her before that. So then the question begs itself. So then why did the Torah allow the father to marry her off from day one? Right? Isn't that an obvious question? So let's try to answer that question based on Tosfos' question. Tosfos says, on that Gemara, Tosfos says, why do we marry our daughters off when they're young? The Gemara says, you're not supposed to marry off your daughter until she's big enough, she's old enough to say, I want him as my husband. Tosfos answers, we have crusades every few years. We know that we cannot forecast how long we will live. And it's very possible that we won't be around to marry off our daughters. And so out of fear, because we don't really know what's going to be down the road, in order to protect their daughters, to ensure that there'll be someone there to care for them, that it's not only on our shoulders that everything's going to be okay for our daughters. There's someone else out there who's looking after them. There's another family who's looking after them. That's why we marry off our daughters when they're still very young. That's Tosis's answer. Now let's look back at our parasha. The Torah says a person can take his daughter and make her a servant. So he takes a 7-year-old daughter and sells her to be a servant. What would be the logic in that? It seems simple. The guy sees that he can't afford to put bread on the table. The kids are going around hungry. His boys are going around panhandling. And he's concerned. I'm going to send my daughter out on the streets panhandling? I'm in heavy debt. What's going to be? How much longer can I handle this? And what type of life am I leading her to? Where is she going to end up? What are the odds I'm going to be able to keep her out of prostitution? So the Torah says, I'm going to give you a system where you can shift her up a notch in the world. What does the Torah allow a father to do? You can sell your daughter as a servant to someone's home. What's going to happen? Your 7-year-old Esther is going to go out there to someone's house and do the dishes, deal with the kids, play with them. And chances are, if she's going to spend the next 5 years in his home, either he will like her or his son will like her. And who can purchase a girl as a servant? Someone who's wealthier than the guy who's selling her, right? So then you're protecting her for those years. During those years, she has all her needs taken care of. And you're giving her an opportunity to be in the home of someone who might marry her. And the Torah even encourages him to marry her. The Torah says you have a mitzvah to marry her. Any other woman on the block, if you marry her, okay, very good, good for you, you married her. This girl, you have a mitzvah to marry her. So the Torah is encouraging the master who purchased this Jewish girl, and the father, by the way, can only sell her when she's a minor. The idea is you're not selling her into this terrible situation, you're putting her in a good situation, where she will have an opportunity to move up in the world. And every day he sees her. What's sweeter than a little girl playing in his house? If he doesn't like her, his son might like her. And the Torah says, if you want to marry her, you don't have to buy her a ring. That money you paid the father to begin with, that money is kiddushin already. So to speak, the Torah is saying, it's a done deal. You already did half the job. Now it's just up to you to approve it. The Torah is saying, you paid, so you should know that the money you paid is kiddushin. Unless you say not. You guys understand the way the Torah set up the master? The idea is, we almost got her married off. Now it's up to you to decide. Do you like her? Does your son like her? Does your other son like her? And that's a way of ensuring, A, that the girl is protected for those years, and she's going to come out of their home. They're going to have a mitzvah, special mitzvah we'll still learn about, to give her gifts. If at the end of 6 years they decide, or when she becomes 12, that they're not going to marry her, just isn't for them, they have a mitzvah. They're going to give her jewelry, they're going to give her good dresses, they have a mitzvah to give her gifts when she leaves their house. She's coming back home, she's a kalamedel, she comes back home in a state that she's ready to be married. So the Torah gives the father an opportunity to protect his daughter. Yes, can this, like every mitzvah, can it be abused? Sure, every mitzvah can be abused. We're coming up to Purim. So you have people who get drunk and they go around beating up other people. Yeah, you could abuse every mitzvah. That's true. But at the end of the day, the Torah gave us a beautiful mitzvah. The Torah gave us a mitzvah that should only be used under dire circumstances. But at the end of the day, it's there. The Torah gave us a welfare system. That's what we're learning about when we learn about servants and slaves. In our parasha, what we're really learning about is the Torah's welfare system, which also works with Yovel. Meaning, what happens on Yovel? All the slaves go free. All the fields go back to their original owner. So let's say a guy says, I can't hack it. I'm going to have my ear pierced. Now I'm going to stay with him till Yovel. When Yovel comes, all his debts are gone. All his fields are back. He gets a fresh start. It's like reset the timer, start from scratch. So the Torah set up a welfare system where a guy can go back into life, no more credit card debt, no more mortgage. Everything is his. His whole family's lands come back to him. He has money in his pocket because he finished his slavery. His family's been taken care of for all these years, and he's done real work. It's not a welfare system where a guy could cop out and just take in the paycheck. It's a welfare system where his master is making sure that he's really working. The Torah also gives us mitzvos to curtail abuse. The Torah gives us mitzvos which say you can't make him do work for nothing. You can't give him back-breaking labor. There are mitzvos to protect him. And Beis Din oversees those mitzvos. But at the end of the day, this is the Torah's welfare system. Yes?
Let's say he only works for 2 years and then Yovel comes.
Right.
He hasn't worked enough to make enough money that he still gets everything back.
Well, his debts are annulled. When Yovel comes, all debts are annulled.
But he didn't make enough money to support himself still.
But all fields come back, meaning he gets back all his family's properties now. The Torah has a reset button every 49 years. All lands come back. You have a reset button. So, what? Well, the Torah demands that he shouldn't cheat the master. Even if the master isn't learned, he should only sell himself with the price that makes sense. Meaning the Torah is also there to protect the master. Well, that's a biblical prohibition to steal. You wouldn't want to do that, right? And don't forget that we have a halacha that even though Shemitah, really, it's not Yovel. Yovel is one of the Shemitah years. Shemitah annuls all debt. It doesn't annul taxes. Meaning, if there's a tax that the Torah placed on a person, a knas, where the Torah said this is a punishment, then even though Shemitah is going to come and Yovel is going to come, he's going to have to pay. Because what Shemitah annuls is a personal debt between two people. And when the Torah taxes, that's not a personal debt. That's like the Torah saying, I want you to pay. It's not about him. I know you stole from him, and I said you should pay double to him. But that double is not about him. The prime value, you owe him. The double, the Torah says, I want you to pay. I don't care if you pay it to the courts, but it has to leave your pocket. It's not about who it's going to as much as leaving the person's pocket. It's a punishment. A knas is a punishment. And that's why Shemitah does not annul a knas. Okay. We have any other questions? What else? You wanted to deal with a convert. Yeah.
You said that it was a mitzvah to for the master's family to marry the girl.
Correct.
That in this question?
Yes. V'im livno ye'adena. Yeah. So the Torah says if the master's family marries her, so then they have to give her like any other wife. So what are the rights of any wife? Did you guys learn about this a little bit? It says she'ira kesuta ve'onata lo yigra, that a person should not diminish from what he owes her. She'ira kesuta ve'onata. He has to give her her food, she'era, the food that a husband ordinarily gives a wife, kesuta, clothing, ve'onata, which literally means her time. So these are the three things a husband owes his wife. This is what it says in the ksuba. Ve'izun, I will feed. Va'achalkel, I will support. He says, I'm going to take care of you. I will even give you from the shirt off my back. That's what you write in the ksuba. Down to the shirt off my back. Every one of you is going to sign that in your ksuba. Yes, every one of you will sign that in your ksuba. What? Yeah.
And we won't have to give our shirts.
And you won't
have
to give your shirts, right.
Wear two shirts.
Two shirts. It says, that's why it says off your back. Down to the bottom shirt. What's ona? So ona is the biblical mitzvah for a couple to be intimate. And Chazal defined that biblical mitzvah applies. The night that a woman goes to mikvah, meaning when a woman has her period, so they become prohibited. They're prohibited for about 13 days, 13, 12, 14, somewhere around there, depending on how long it takes for her to finish. And then she goes to the mikvah, she immerses herself in the mikvah water, she comes back home. The couple could again be together after almost half a month where they couldn't. So that night is one biblical mitzvah of ona. Any night before the husband goes away on a trip, if he's going to be away for a while, so he has a mitzvah of ona. The night he comes back from a trip, he has a mitzvah of ona. And any night that his wife indicates to him that she desires for them to be intimate, he has a biblical mitzvah of ona. So you have here, we said so far, four examples of a biblical mitzvah for a couple to be intimate. Aside from that, there are set times, set intervals when he owes his wife to be intimate with her. How often? Well, that depends on how much free time he has every night. If the guy comes home at 4 o'clock and he has nothing to do for the rest of the night, then every night he has a mitzvah. If the guy has a regular job, so we assume twice a week he has a mitzvah. Now, Halacha and Shulchan Aruch delineates, depending on how much time a person has, how much free time he has, how much of a mitzvah he has. But there's an underlying theme here. Meaning the mitzvah of onah isn't discussing how often does the average person want to be intimate. Because the average person has stages. When they're younger, so they're more excited. When they, as they age, so they're less excited. It's a part of the natural cycle of things. But what the Torah is telling us is that a husband has to give his wife the feeling that he desires her as much as can be. And that any time that he can, he does show his affection. So a wife thinks to herself, if he's spending every night he has off from 4 o'clock and he's up till 12 or till 11, 7 hours he's got nothing to do and he never takes time to think about me, so it's not that there's a physical desire for intimacy, there's an emotional need to feel that if it were possible he would be with me. That's the feeling a husband has to give his wife. I would really want to be with you 24/7, but I can't. I have to live life. So at least when I can, I am. So if we haven't been together for 14 days, then there's a mitzvah that if there's going to be the first night when it's available, I show her, hey, I couldn't wait. Baruch Hashem, we're back together again. Biblical mitzvah of onah. He's going to be away for a two-week trip. He has a biblical mitzvah to show her, hey, I'm going to be away, I'm going to miss you. So the last night we're going to be. The first night he gets back, again he has a biblical mitzvah. And anytime she indicates it to him. And even those set intervals that Chazal set up for us are set intervals based on the way Chazal understood a woman's mind works. How often does she expect him to be interested? Aside from the times we said before, how often is going to be enough to make her feel like he is really, really interested in her? So the idea of ona is to give her that positive feeling. So we have three things that a husband has to give his wife, and the Torah stresses, even if you marry that girl that was a servant in the house, don't diminish that she'er ksus and ona. She has to get the same as any other girl. The Torah gives us the mitzvah, if a person murders, and there's witnesses, and they warn him, so then he gets a death penalty, and if he does it by mistake, he runs away to an ir miklat. The Torah tells us there's no freebie for the Kohanim, the priests can't get away with murder, take a person away even from the altar. And then the Torah tells us if a person wounds his parent, a father or a mother, he gets a death penalty. And that's why, ideally, a person should not be the doctor for his parents. Because if you let out a drop more blood than necessary, that's a biblical prohibition. Even if you didn't mean to do it, you got to be careful. If there's no one else to do it, so you do it and be as careful as possible. And the truth is, this isn't only about one's parents. This is true about any doctor. About parents, there's a death penalty. There's the weight of a death penalty on the sin. But any other doctor has the same prohibition. A doctor has to be careful to inflict the minimum amount of pain and the minimum amount of bloodletting. And that's every doctor's responsibility. A person curses his parents, so also there's the death penalty. We have the mitzvos of a person who damages his fellow man, that he has to pay his doctor bills. And here we have the first mention of a doctor. From here we derive that human beings are supposed to go to doctors, because ordinarily a person might say, if God wanted me healthy, I'd be healthy. If God made me sick, what am I arguing with God for? Let me do tshuva, and God will do whatever he sees fit. No, says the Torah. Maybe God sent the illness so that you go and pay the doctor, so that you have to go out there. We have halacha that when a person harms his fellow man, he has to pay his medical bills. And from here we see that, yes, the Torah meant for us to go to doctors. The Torah says, if a person kills his servant, he gets a death penalty. If that servant dies that day. And here we have two understandings in this mitzvah, which give us an insight into what the Torah was teaching us. One understanding says the Torah wanted to protect the servant. So the Torah said if you hit the servant and he dies that day, so then a person would get the death penalty. The other understanding says it's not about the servant. It's about us. The Torah wasn't giving us this halacha because the Torah wanted to protect the servant, but rather the Torah was looking at us and saying, what kind of person are you? How could you beat the slave to a point where he died? The Torah was focused on us being decent people. And that's why the Torah gave the death penalty. And this gives us two alternate understandings into punishments in the Torah. Meaning there's a philosophical discussion, why should courts administer punishment? Is it as a deterrent? Is it as a social justice system? That society has to ensure there's justice? So here we have two alternate understandings. Either because he killed the servant, so that the Torah wanted to prevent that as a deterrent, the Torah gave death penalty for that. Or the Torah said, you have to be a better type of person. It's about you. A third concept within the Torah. We have the verse that says, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. So our tradition says, there's no such thing as an eye for an eye. Person takes out someone else's eye, you do not take out his eye. You evaluate it. We have halacha how you evaluate it. You go to the slave market and you evaluate how much would this person be sold on the slave market. How much would he be worth with two eyes? How much is he worth now that he lost an eye? You evaluate how much the loss is. You also evaluate the pain. You evaluate the medical bills. You evaluate the disability. We evaluate all that. But you don't do an eye for an eye. So the verse says an eye for an eye. And our tradition says no, no such thing. So Maimonides points out in his introduction to the Mishnah that this is something we see throughout the Torah. We have verses where no one says it should be interpreted literally, such as this verse. Everyone agrees to the tradition of what an esrog is. The Torah says, Pri Eitz Hadar, I want you to take the fruit of a glorious fruit from a tree. Doesn't say which fruit. Maybe I should take a lemon, maybe an orange. I like a pumela. No. Everyone agrees what an esrog is. That the Rambam says yes. Everyone agrees. There's no discussion. That's our tradition. And we could add to this the famous Psikta Rav Kahana. The Medrash says, when Hashem gave the Torah, he knew full well the nations would translate our Torah and walk around saying they're the real Jews. You guys have to be careful. That's how missionaries work. There are a lot of missionaries in this country too. And they come to you innocently saying, I'm here for Judaism, and do you want to know what this prophet said and that prophet said? So Hashem knew that would happen, that nations would claim they're the real Jews. So Hashem said, okay, I'm giving the Torah in a way that you can't really understand it. You can't get it right without a tradition. There's a written law, there's the oral law. And if anyone tries to sever between the two, they're going to end up with a botched up system. Anyone who tried keeping Torah without a tradition, without knowing the Torah Shebaal Peh, ended up with a botched up system. The Karaites, the Kutim, the Shomronim, the Sadducees, the Baitusis, every generation had their reform movement. And they all ended up in the same place in history. The Torah tells us if a person knocks out an eye or a tooth of a slave, or blinds the slave, slices off his finger, so then the slave goes free, a non-Jewish slave. So there are 24 heads of limbs, right? You have 10 fingers, 10 toes, a nose. The Talmud delineates what are the 24 limbs. Rashi over here brings it, two ears, etc. So you have the tooth, the eye, and another 24 limbs. So why does the Torah stress the eye or the tooth? So why do we call a non-Jewish servant an Eved Kanani? Who is the first servant in Jewish history? Canaan. Noach's son was cursed in the Bible. He was cursed in the Torah. Eved Avadim Yelechav. What did Canaan do that he got cursed? Canaan walked into the tent when his father was drunk, looked at his father rolling around naked. Canaan. But Canaan was cursed. So it says, "Vayomer Arur Kenan Eved Avadim Yelechad." So it says, "Okay, Vaidgal Betoch Alo Vayal Cham Avi Kenan Et Avat Aviv." So Chazal say, "Why does it say Vayar Cham Avi Kenan? Why is it stressed that he's the father of Kenan?" So it means, one interpretation, Canaan went in there. I think it was Canaan, the Midrash says, that went and called Ham and said, look at what Grandpa's doing, rolling around all naked. So he went and looked, and then he went and spoke. So he was cursed to be the servant. Canaan was cursed. He's going to be a slave. So every slave, every non-Jewish slave, is described as like Eved Kenani. He's going the way of Canaan. Canaan ended up being a slave. Now, where was Canaan's main sin? With his eye and with his mouth. So if a servant has his eye knocked out or his tooth knocked out, the Torah stresses those two limbs, because those two limbs, so to speak, it's saying he got punished for what he did already. Meaning it was, it's as though we're saying Canaan already paid his price. The responsibility for our animals is very important. The halacha says if you have a dog, you can't let that dog run around without a leash because it might scare people. If you have a dog, it has to be in a manner where people feel comfortable walking around that dog. It's not enough that you tell them, oh, don't worry, it doesn't bite. I was walking down a few days ago, and people were letting their dogs run around, and I'm standing there, and this huge dog comes right next to me, and there's no leash. And the master's standing about 10 feet away, and he says, don't worry, he's a friendly dog. And I was thinking to myself, I wish I had a snake. I wish I had a snake I could wrap around his neck and say, don't worry, it's a friendly snake. Don't worry, it won't bite, you know. He wouldn't trust my snake. Why should I trust his dog? But dogs, somehow people think that's okay. No, the halacha says you're not allowed to scare people. If you have a dog, there has to be a chain on it that's visible, that it's enough to hold him from biting people. That's the halacha. People say you're not allowed to own a dog. I don't know, David HaMelech owned a dog. Mara says David had a dog. So I don't know about that. But you do have to keep it in a way that it won't harm people and it won't even look like it can harm people. We have a responsibility, even if things don't belong to us, if we enable them to do harm. Meaning, if a person throws out his cigarette, so the cigarette causes a fire, you'll say, that's not my fire. Yes, it is. A person walks in the street, or a person drives in the street and his car rounds the bend and he goes over the bend and knocks off the cover of the sewer. Here in Israel, many of the sewer covers on the sidewalks are not really attached. So if your car runs the sidewalk a little bit, runs the curb, it can knock off the cover of a sewer. So a person's responsible for that. That's the damage of bor. And the halacha expects of us to be considerate of other people walking in public domain. So if I walk down the steps and I see that there's an oil slick, oh, I had this here. We live by a hill. We live by a hill that goes all the way down to the entrance to the city. And someone decided to dump all their oil there. So you had a situation where you couldn't even walk, meaning you tried walking across, not even walking down the hill, and shoop, you went flying. So I didn't know this. But there are two things. One, the way to deal with this is to pour sand over it, dirt or sand. And if you call the iria, they'll come down and they'll pour sand over it. I was walking by a building site here in Givat Shaul, and they had dug, in order to lay the foundations, they had dug into the ground, I don't know, it must have been 40 feet. I mean, really deep. And there was supposed to be a gate there. But what can you do? The gate had shifted. So where the gate was supposed to be blocking the place where you could fall in, well, it was only 2 feet in. So you could only fall, 40 feet on a two-feet gap. And there was a place right near children's school where about 300 kids walked by every day. So I called the area. I called the area and I say, you know, there's a construction site here. About 300 kids are going to walk by here soon. And there's a hole. So they said, we're going to send someone right over. That right over took 3 hours. How do I know? Because I stayed right there. I couldn't leave. That's the halacha of bor. If you see something in public domain that could be harmful to other people, then we have a responsibility to deal with it. I didn't want to stay there. I have a life too, you know. I was put... For 3 hours, I had to stay there till someone came and covered it. But there's a danger to people there, and you can't walk away from a danger. So the idea of bar is we have a responsibility for things in public domain. If we did it or we can prevent it, we have to deal with it. We have the famous halacha that if a person steals sheep or an ox and he's caught, so then he doesn't pay the standard tax of double, but he has to pay four times for a sheep, five times for an ox. Let's move forward. You want us to deal with the halachas of converts. So first let's introduce and then we'll work our way to that. The Torah says, not in our parsha, later on we'll learn it, the Torah says twice, Velo tonu ishet amito, don't afflict your fellow man. Don't afflict your fellow man. Why does the Torah repeat it twice? So we have a tradition. One is telling you that in business you should be fair. A new ole walks into your makolet, and you have a bag of milk, and he asks you, how much is that? And you say, six. So he pulls out $6 and gives it to you. So you say, thank you. Goodbye. It was six shekel. Why'd you let him pay $6? There's a standard price. Things that have a standard price, you're not allowed to deviate more than 1/6 from the standard price. So that's lo tonu. The first halacha is, don't be unfair in your business practices. Now, people misapply this. I once had a landlord who called me up in the middle of the contract and said, you know, I'm raising your price by an exorbitant amount. So I said, we have a contract. What do you mean? So he said to me, lo tonu ishet amito. I think that the standard rate is X above what you're paying, and you're paying me more than a sixth less than I think you should be paying me, so our contract is null and void. So that's not what the halacha is talking about. In real estate, everyone knows there are more expensive apartments, less expensive apartments. Sometimes you get a better deal, a worse deal. We're talking about a bag of milk. There's a set price. Everyone knows what the price should be. A loaf of bread. So there's a deviation. You can make a little bit more profit, less profit, a sufganiya. There are certain things everyone knows. There's a rate. You live in the place. You know what the rate is. You don't live in the place, you don't know.
It's a question. So how do you determine based on prices that fluctuate more, like, for example,
rooms? So I'm not so sure you could say that. You know, it has to be really far out. Aside from which, there are other halachos, which deserve a longer discussion, and whether bichlal in real estate you could say.
Because on the other hand, you
can't
get a sort of an average of some of these
items. So who's... Okay, deserves a longer discussion. There's a concept also of... I don't want to go into it.
Sure.
But I'm just saying, the Torah said, lotonu. First lotonu was, don't be dishonest in your business practices. Second biblical prohibition, lotonu ishetamito, is don't say something that's hurtful to someone. So the Torah is careful with us. If a person said one word that hurt someone else's feelings, that's a biblical prohibition. Lo tonu, don't afflict, don't say something that's hurtful. So what's an example of that? The Talmud says an example of that is, let's say you're walking down the street and it's really hot and you see a jewelry store and you decide you're going to go in there and enjoy the air conditioning. So you're not just going to walk in and enjoy the air conditioning, so you tell the owner, you tell him, could you tell me how much that is? Now, what's about that? You spend 10 minutes, and he's pouring his guts out trying to convince you why this is good and that's good, and it's a fair price. And you tell him, don't you think your prices are a little high? And he says, no, what are you talking about? And back and forth. And after you finish, you say, you know what, I'll think about it. You're not going to think about it. You knew all along you weren't going to buy anything. To walk into a store and take his time and take his efforts and energies when you don't think you're going to buy something, the Gemara says that's called lotonu. That's included.
So what's the problem? So what's in the end you decide, I don't want to buy it. It's really too expensive.
If that's fine. If you had a thought you might buy it, I said that if you thought you might, if it's possible you would have bought it, fine. But if it's a situation where you know you're not going to buy it, that's a different story. Sometimes that's why I said you walked in for the air conditioning.
Yeah, but it depends on what can be the for the like. Store owner, so he's not going to know that you want to buy. He might know that you really want to buy and you do the same things. So it might be a problem from this store owner.
But
I got once something like this. I had like that. This was, but I came in the store and I took this and that. It really was expensive.
Right. So that's fair.
I said I want to buy, so I went out.
Right, that's okay. Yeah, but that's his problem. You're entitled not to buy. Saying, no, if you thought you might buy, that's enough. You don't have to be convinced you're going to buy. That's what you're going in there for. You're going to see. Maybe yes, maybe no. That's okay. That's what you're supposed to do. And if you decide not, gemarnu. And you should just know that this is something they teach you in business school. That one of the tactics to get someone to buy is to act insulted if they don't. This is a tactic. This is a sales tactic. Is my merchandise not good enough for you? You know, I can't believe you'd leave my store without buying something. Just take a look at this. Don't you think this is... There is such a tactic. I've seen it done... people tried to do it on me too. What?
Middle East culture approach.
I had it done on me in Midtown Manhattan. In a suit store. So it's not only Middle East. Yeah.
Are we talking only about personal interaction? Like, if I where I live, for instance, there's 4 restaurants, okay, and there's only a bathroom in bed, but I never eat in bed. I would eat in Vietnam. So I said, "Do you have a bathroom?" He said, "No, go into bed. They have a bathroom." So I just walk into bed. I don't say anything. I just go to the bathroom, and it's like basically a community bathroom there.
So, I don't know what to say about that. I don't know.
Is that, but because I don't even go up to the counter or...
It's not loto nuishet amito. No, it's not that. Right.
Not that I'm benefiting without...
That's a different question. That's not loto nu.
You know,
right.
Business.
That's a different question. You're not afflicting them. It could be stealing, but it's not afflicting. It's a different question, right? So we have mitzvos which the Torah repeats for a ger. You have the avtal racha kamocha. And then it says, Vavtem et ager. But I'm supposed to love him, he's a Jew. Yeah, you have another mitzvah to love him. You have a mitzvah not to afflict your fellow man. The Torah says, don't afflict the ger. So the logical understanding of it is, the ger is new. He doesn't know the system. He doesn't have people to fight for him. He's easy prey. Came the Torah and warned you. The Torah didn't even say yet, don't afflict your fellow man. The Torah first tells you, be careful with the ger. We haven't yet had the warning about our fellow man. Right. But when you have the whole picture of the Torah and you see the ger was really covered when the Torah said you're not allowed to afflict a fellow Jew, so then you understand that the Torah repeated it for stress. And if a person does afflict the ger, he transgresses that many more transgressions. So the Torah gave him extra protection. If someone said a word to him that hurt his feelings, assuming it was an unfair word, you know, it's not only gauged by the recipient, it's also gauged by fairness. We have at the end of the parsha, Am Yisrael says, Naaseh v'nishma. But before we get there, I want to address one more thing that happens often. Almost every year, guys come over to me and they tell me, you know, I gave a loan to a fellow student and he's not in the country anymore. Okay, what can I do? we have a mitzvah in our parsha to give loans. We have a mitzvah to give a poor person a loan. We have a mitzvah not to keep pounding him for the money, not to take interest. But like the Chafetz Chaim writes in Ahavat Chesed, the Torah wanted us to do it intelligently. You're going to give a loan? Take collateral. The guy says he needs the money? No problem. So after I lent out the stapler from the office numerous times and never got it back, so today, if someone wants to borrow scissors or a stapler, I say, leave me your tudat zehut. They say, for scissors? I say, no problem. You said you're giving them back in 5 minutes. You'll get your tudat zehut back in 5 minutes. You know what? I always got back the scissors. So it seems extreme. But after I put, you know, you'll see in the office, I donated some of the equipment there. It says on it in big letters, Hebrew, English, every language you want. It says on every side, this belongs to the English department office. Please do not remove from here. Must be returned to here. It disappeared for a year and a half. And so the Torah says, yes, you have a mitzvah to give a loan. But the Torah didn't say you have to be stupid. You want to give a loan? Fine. Take collateral. Take co-signers. Let someone else be share the responsibility. The fact that I have a mitzvah to give a loan does not mean I shouldn't take collateral. You want a loan of 50 shekel? Your watch is worth 300 shekel? Leave me your watch. You'll manage without it. Leave me your cell phone. Leave me something that I have collateral that I'll get it back. And there's nothing wrong with that. Yes, you have a mitzvah to give a loan, but there's no reason you shouldn't protect yourself. Make sure your collateral is worth something. Yeah. And finally, what does Nasa v'nishma mean? We also have the mitzvah of Tzar Balei Chaim. So Tzar Balei Chaim means unnecessary pain. We pain animals, sure, we're all wearing leather belts, so leather shoes. We're all wearing animal products. So the idea of Tzar Balei Chaim is unnecessary pain. Whatever you need is permissible. Whatever you're going to use, the Torah didn't say I want you to do everything so an animal doesn't suffer. The Torah said you shouldn't do it unnecessarily. Whatever you use, you're allowed to eat meat, you're allowed to wear leather clothing, that's fine. It's true that we have that sensitivity that we don't make a special blessing on leather clothing, because an animal's had to give its life for that leather, but you could still wear leather clothing.
The issue of these days in terms of the practices that we use to get the product.
Right? Yeah. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote that he didn't like they had soft meat. I don't remember what it was called. They still have it.
Japanese.
No. In America, everyone eats it. No. Was it maybe lamb chops? There was some kind of
veal.
Veal.
Yeah.
How do they make veal?
Yeah.
When the baby's animal's born, they leave it in a little cage, and then it never develops strong muscles. It could never stand on its own feet. And after they feed it, in that little cage where it can never stand on its feet and walk around, then they slaughter it and you have really soft meat. So Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote that. He doesn't think that's the way of the Torah. It's not prohibited. You're allowed to eat veal. You're allowed to have that soft meat. It's not like it's a prohibition. But at the end of the day, how much suffering are you causing a little animal so that you could have your soft meat? That's not like there's a famous tshuva of the Noda Bihuda where they asked him about going hunting. So he said that there's no prohibition, because again, it's something that you're benefiting from, so you're allowed to do it, but that's not the way you should be developing your soul. A Jew should not spend his time going hunting, that his fun is the suffering of another animal. If you need another animal, you're allowed to use it. Are you allowed to go hunting? Is it permissible? Yes. But is it the way a person should behave? No. Naseh v'nishma. What does naseh v'nishma mean? So Rashi writes that naseh means we will do, and nishma means we will do. Yes. Nishma means we will obey. Naseh v'nishma. We will do and we will obey, which is in essence saying we will do. So Am Yisrael says, naseh v'nishma. We will perform whatever you say, God. And that is said over the written law. But the oral law, who wants the oral law? That involves listening to rabbis and no one wanted that. The oral law is tough. The written law is easy. You read Torah, it works. You start opening a Gemara, it's tough. So the Medrash Tanhuma says at the end of the parasha, they didn't want that. They saw it was tough, they saw it involved all that, they didn't want it. At the end of the parasha, Hashem tells Moshe, come up the mountain, I will give you the Luchos, the Torah, the mitzvah that I wrote to teach them. Chazal say this means that Moshe received at Sinai, Torah, the Ten Commandments, Mishnah, Gemara, and all of prophets. All the concepts that are in prophets were given to him. So the Mishnah and the Gemara that we have today are descendants. They're an evolvement of the oral law that already existed in the days of Moshe. Moshe received Mishnah and Gemara, and we have one chapter that is exactly the way it was when Moshe received it, and that is the chapter in Zvachim, Ezeu, Mekomon. There's no machlokas in that chapter. It's said exactly the way Moshe gave it from Sinai.